his palm. With a furious force, it was flung against the wall. It rebounded with a tiny, sharp clangor, gleaming harmlessly as it flew. The uniformed man shrugged. "So much for that, then. It would have done you no good in any case, Captain. I am not the mule. You will have to be satisfied with his viceroy."
"How did you know?" muttered the captain thickly.
"Blame it on an efficient counter-espionage system. I can name every member of your little gang, every step of their planning."
"And you let it go this far?"
"Why not? It has been one of my great purposes here to find you and some others. Particularly you. I might have had you some months ago while you were still a worker at the Newton Bearings Works. But this is much better. If you hadn't suggested the main outlines of the plot yourself, one of my own men would have advanced something of much the same sort for you. The result is quite dramatic, and rather grimly humorous."
The captain's eyes were hard. "I find it so, too. Is it all over now?"
"Just begun. Come, Captain, sit down. Let us leave heroics for the fools who are impressed by it. Captain, you are a capable man. According to the information I have, you were the first on the Foundation to recognize the power of the mule. Since then, you have interested yourself, rather daringly, in the mule's early life. You have been one of those who carried off his clown, who incidentally has not yet been found, and for which there will yet be full payment. Naturally, your ability is recognized, and the mule is not of those who fear the ability of his enemies as long as he can convert it into the ability of a new friend."
"Is that what you're hedging up to?"
"Oh, no. Oh, yes. It was the purpose of tonight's comedy. You are an intelligent man, yet your little conspiracies against the mule fail humorously. You can scarcely dignify it with the name of conspiracy. Is it part of your military training to waste ships in hopeless actions?"
"One must first admit them to be hopeless."
"One will," the viceroy assured him gently. "The mule has conquered the Foundation. It is rapidly being turned into an arsenal for accomplishment of his greater aims."
"What greater aims?"
"The conquest of the entire galaxy. The reunion of all the torn worlds into a new empire. The fulfillment, you dull-witted patriot, of your own Selden's dream 700 years before he hoped to see it. And in the fulfillment, you can help us."
"I can, undoubtedly. But I won't, undoubtedly."
"I understand," reasoned the viceroy, "that only 3 of the independent trading worlds yet resist. They will not last much longer. It will be the last of all Foundation forces. You still hold out?"
"Yes."
"Yet you won't. A voluntary recruit is the most efficient. But the other kind will do. Unfortunately, the mule is absent. He leads the fight, as always, against the resisting traders. But he is in continual contact with us. You will not have to wait long."
"For what?"
"For your conversion."
"The mule," said the captain frigidly, "will find that beyond his ability."
"But he won't. I was not beyond it. You don't recognize me. Come, you were on Calgan, so you have seen me. I wore a monocle, a fur-lined scarlet robe, a high-crowned hat."
The captain stiffened in dismay.
"You were the warlord of Calgan."
"Yes. And now I am the loyal viceroy of the mule. You see, he is persuasive."
Chapter 21.
Interlude in space. The blockade was run successfully. In the vast volume of space, not all the navies ever in existence could keep their watch in tight proximity. Given a single ship, a skillful pilot, and a moderate degree of luck, and there are holes and despair. With cold-eyed calm, Torin drove a protesting vessel from the vicinity of one star to that of another. If the neighborhood of Great Mass made an interstellar jump erratic and difficult, it also made the enemy detection devices useless, or nearly so. And once the girdle of ships had been passed, the inner sphere of dead space, through whose blockaded sub-ether no message could be driven, was passed as well. For the first time in over 3 months, Torin felt unisolated. A week passed before the enemy news programs dealt with anything more than the dull, self-laudatory details of growing control over the Foundation. It was a week in which Torin's armored trading ship fled inward from the periphery in hasty jumps. Ebling Nice called out to the pilot room, and Torin rose blink-eyed from his charts. "What's the matter?" Torin stepped down into the small central chamber which Beta had inevitably devised into a living room. Meese shook his head. "Be scuppered if I know. The Mule's newsmen are announcing a special bulletin. Thought you might want to get in on it."
"Might as well. Where's Beta?"
"Setting the table in the diner and picking out a menu, or some such frippery." Torin sat down upon the cot that served as Magnifico's bed and waited. The propaganda routine of the Mule's special bulletins were monotonously similar. First the martial music, and then the buttery slickness of the announcer. The minor news items would come, following one another in patient lockstep. Then the pause. Then the trumpets and the rising excitement and the climax. Torin endured it. Meese muttered to himself. The newscaster spilled out, in conventional war correspondent phraseology, the unctuous words that translated into sound the molten metal and blasted flesh of a battle in space. "Rapid cruiser squadrons under Lieutenant General Salmon hit back hard today at the task force striking out from Iss." The carefully expressionless face of the speaker upon the screen faded into the blackness of a space cut through by the quick swaths of ships reeling across emptiness in deadly battle. The voice continued through the soundless thunder. "The most striking action of the battle was the subsidiary combat of the heavy cruiser Cluster against three enemy ships of the Nova class." The screen's view veered and closed in. A great ship sparked and one of the frantic attackers glowed angrily, twisted out of focus, swung back, and rammed. The Cluster bowed wildly and survived the glancing blow that drove the attacker off in twisting reflection. The newsman's smooth, unimpassioned delivery continued to the last blow and the last hulk. Then a pause and a large, similar voice and picture of the flight off Nemen, to which the novelty was added of a lengthy description of a hit-and-run landing, the picture of a blasted city, huddled and weary prisoners, and off again. Nemen had not long to live. The pause again, and this time the raucous sound of the expected brasses. The screen faded into the long, impressively soldier-lined corridor up which the government spokesman in counselor's uniform strode quickly. The silence was oppressive. The voice that came at last was solemn, slow, and hard. "By order of our sovereign, it is announced that the planet Haven, hitherto in warlike opposition to his will, has submitted to the acceptance of defeat. At this moment, the forces of our sovereign are occupying the planet. Opposition was scattered, uncoordinated, and speedily crushed." The scene faded out. The original newsman returned to state importantly that other developments would be transmitted as they occurred. Then there was dance music, and Ebling Meese threw the shield that cut the power. Torin rose and walked unsteadily away without a word. The psychologist made no move to stop him. When Beta stepped out of the kitchen, Mies motioned silence. He said, "They've taken Haven." And Beta said, "Already?" Her eyes were round and sick with disbelief. "Without a fight. Without an unprint..." He stopped and swallowed. "You'd better leave Torin alone. It's not pleasant for him. Suppose we eat without him this once." Beta looked once toward the pilot room, then turned hopelessly. "Very well." Magnifico sat unnoticed at the table. He neither spoke nor ate, but stared ahead with a concentrated face that seemed to drain all the vitality out of his thread of a body. Ebling Mies pushed absently at his iced fruit dessert and said harshly, "Two trading worlds fight. They fight and bleed and die and don't surrender. Only at Haven. Just as at the Foundation. But why? Why?" The psychologist shook his head. "It's of a piece with all the problem. Every queer facet is a hint at the nature of the mule. First, the problem of how he could conquer the Foundation with little blood and at a single blow, essentially, while the independent trading worlds held out. The blanket on nuclear reactions was a puny weapon. We've discussed that back and forth till I'm sick of it, and it did not work on any but the Foundation. Randu suggested..." And Ebling's grisly eyebrows pulled together. "It might have been a radiant will depressor. It's what might have done the work on Haven. But then why wasn't it used on Nemen and Iss, which even now fight with such demonic intensity that it is taking half the Foundation fleet in addition to the Mule's forces to beat them down? Yes, I recognized Foundation ships in the attack." Beta whispered, "The Foundation? Then Haven? Disaster seems to follow us without touching. We always seem to get out by a hair. Will it last forever?" Ebling Mies was not listening. To himself, he was making a point. "But there's another problem. Another problem. Beta, you remember the news item that the Mule's clown was not found on Terminus? That it was suspected he had fled to Haven or been carried there by his original kidnappers? There is an importance attached to him, Beta, that doesn't fade, and we have not located it yet. Magnifico must know something that is fatal to the Mule. I'm sure of it." Magnifico, white and stuttering, protested, "Sire, noble lord, indeed, I swear it is past my poor reckoning to penetrate your wants. I have told what I know to the utter limits, and with your probe you have drawn out of my meager wit that which I knew, but knew not that I knew." "I know. I know. It is something small. A hint so small that neither you nor I recognize it for what it is. Yet I must find it. For Nemen and Iss will go soon, and when they do, we are the last remnants, the last droplets of the independent Foundation." The stars begin to cluster closely when the core of the galaxy is penetrated. Gravitational fields begin to overlap at intensities sufficient to introduce perturbations in an interstellar jump that cannot be overlooked. Torin became aware of that when a jump landed their ship in the full glare of a red giant which clutched viciously and whose grip was loosed, then wrenched apart only after 12 sleepless, soul-battering hours. With charts limited in scope and an experience not at all fully developed, either operationally or mathematically, Torin resigned himself to days of careful plotting between jumps. It became a community project of a sort. Ebling Mies checked Torin's mathematics and Beta tested possible routes by the various generalized methods for the presence of real solutions. Even Magnifico was put to work on the calculating machine for routine computations, a type of work which, once explained, was a source of great amusement to him, and at which he was surprisingly proficient. So at the end of a month, or nearly, Beta was able to survey the red line that wormed its way through the ship's trimensional model of the galactic lens halfway to its center, and say with satiric relish, "You know what it looks like. It looks like a 10-foot earthworm with a terrific case of indigestion. Eventually, you'll land us back in Haven." "I will," growled Torrin with a fierce rustle of his chart, "if you don't shut up." "And at that," continued Beta, "there is probably a route right through, straight as a meridian of longitude." "Yeah? Well, in the first place, dimwit, it probably took 500 ships 500 years to work out that route by hit and miss, and my lousy half-credit charts don't give it. Besides, maybe those straight routes are a good thing to avoid. They're probably choked up with ships. And besides, oh, for galaxy's sake, stop driveling and slavering so much righteous indignation." Her hands were in his hair. He yowled, "Ouch, let go!" seized her wrists and whipped downward, whereupon Torrin, Beta, and Cher formed a tangled threesome on the floor. It degenerated into a panting wrestling match, composed mostly of choking laughter and various foul blows. Torrin broke loose at Magnifico's breathless entrance. "What is it?" The lines of anxiety puckered the clown's face and tightened the skin whitely over the enormous bridge of his nose. "The instruments are behaving queerly, sir. I have not, in the knowledge of my ignorance, touched anything." In 2 seconds, Torrin was in the pilot room. He said quietly to Magnifico, "Wake up Ebling Meese. Have him come down here." He said to Beta, who was trying to get a basic order back to her hair by use of her fingers, "We've been detected, Bay." "Detected?" And Beta's arms dropped. "By whom?" "Galaxy knows," muttered Torrin, "but I imagine by someone with blasters already ranged and trained." He sat down, and in a low voice was already sending into the sub-ether the ship's identification code. And when Ebling Meese entered, bath-robed and blear-eyed, Torrin said with a desperate calm, "It seems we're inside the borders of a local inner kingdom which is called the Autarchy of Philia."
"Never heard of it," said Meese abruptly.
"Well, neither did I," replied Torrin, "but we're being stopped by a Philian ship just the same, and I don't know what it will involve." The captain inspector of the Philian ship crowded aboard with 6 armed men following him. He was short, thin-haired, thin-lipped, and dry-skinned. He coughed a sharp cough as he sat down and threw open the folio under his arm to a blank page.
"Your passports and ship's clearance, please."
"We have none," said Torrin. "None, eh?" He snatched up a microphone suspended from his belt and spoke into it quickly.
3 men and 1 woman. Papers not in order."
He made an accompanying notation in the folio.
He said, "Where are you from?"
"Siwena," said Torrin warily.
"Where is that?"
30,000 parsecs. 80 degrees west, Trantor, 40 degrees.
"Never mind, never mind."
Torrin could see that his inquisitor had written down, "Point of origin, periphery." Aphelion continued, "Where are you going?" Torrin said, "Trantor sector."
"Purpose?"
"Pleasure trip."
"Carrying any cargo?"
"No." "We'll check on that." He nodded and 2 men jumped to activity. Torrin made no move to interfere.
"What brings you into Philian territory?"
The Philian's eyes gleamed unamiably.
"We didn't know we were.
I lack a proper chart."
"You will be required to pay 100 credits for that lack. And, of course, the usual fees required for tariff duties, etc."
He spoke again into the microphone, but listened more than he spoke. Then, to Torrin,
Know anything about nuclear technology?
A little, replied Torrin guardedly.
Yes. The Felian closed his folio and added, The men of the periphery have a knowledgeable reputation that way. Put on a suit and come with me.
Beta stepped forward.
What are you going to do with him?
Torrin put her aside gently and asked coldly, Where do you want me to come?
Our power plant needs minor adjustments. He'll come with you.
His pointing finger aimed directly at Magnifico, whose brown eyes opened wide in a blubbery dismay.
What's he got to do with it? Demanded Torrin fiercely.
The official looked up coldly.
I am informed of pirate activities in this vicinity. A description of one of the known thugs tallies, roughly. It is a purely routine matter of identification.
Torrin hesitated, but 6 men and 6 blasters are eloquent arguments. He reached into the cupboard for the suits. An hour later, he rose upright in the bowels of the Felian ship and raged, There's not a thing wrong with the motors that I can see. The bus bars are true, the L-tubes are feeding properly, and the reaction analysis checks. Who's in charge here?
The head engineer said quietly, I am.
Well, get me out of here.
He was led to the officer's level, and the small anteroom held only an indifferent ensign.
Where's the man who came with me?
Please wait, said the ensign.
It was 15 minutes later that Magnifico was brought in.
What did they do to you? Asked Torrin quickly.
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
Magnifico's head shook a slow negative. It took 250 credits to fulfill the demands, Ophelia. 50 credits of it for instant release, and they were in free space again.
Beta said with a forced laugh,
Don't we raid an escort? Don't we get the usual figurative boot over the border?
And Torrin replied grimly, That was no Felian ship, and we're not leaving for a while. Come in here.
They gathered about him. He said, whitely, That was a Foundation ship, and those were the Mule's men aboard.
Ebling bent to pick up the cigar he had dropped.
He said, Here? We're 15,000 parsecs from the Foundation.
And we're here. What's to prevent them from making the same trip?
Galaxy, Ebling, don't you think I can tell ships apart?
I saw their engines, and that's enough for me. I tell you, it was a Foundation engine in a Foundation ship.
And how did they get here? Asked Beta, logically. What are the chances of a random meeting of 2 given ships in space?
What's that to do with it? Demanded Torrin hotly. It would only show we've been followed.
Followed? Hooted Beta. Through hyperspace?
Ebling Meese interposed wearily. That can be done, given a good ship and a great pilot. But the possibility doesn't impress me.
I haven't been masking my trail, insisted Torrin. I've been building up takeoff speed on the straight. A blind man could have calculated our route.
The blazes he could, cried Beta. With the cockeyed jumps you were making, observing our initial direction didn't mean a thing. We came out of the jump wrong end forwards more than once.
We're wasting time, blazed Torrin with gritted teeth. It's a Foundation ship under the Mule. It's stopped us. It's searched us. It's had Magnifico, alone, with me as hostage to keep the rest of you quiet in case you suspected. And we're going to burn it out of space right now.
Hold on now, and Ebling Meese clutched at him. Are you going to destroy us for one ship you think is an enemy?
Think, man, would those scuppers chase us over an impossible route half through the bestinkered galaxy, look us over, and then let us go?
They're still interested in where we're going.
Then why stop us and put us on our guard?
You can't have it both ways, you know.
I'll have it my way.
Let go of me, Ebling, or I'll knock you down.
Magnifico leaned forward from his balanced perch on his favorite chair back. His long nostrils flared with excitement.
I crave your pardon for my interruption, but my poor mind is of a sudden plagued with a queer thought.
Beta anticipated Torin's gesture of annoyance and added her grip to Ebling's.
Go ahead and speak, Magnifico. We will all listen faithfully.
Magnifico said, In my stay in their ship, what addled wits I have were bemazed and bemused by a chattering fear that befell men. Of a truth, I have a lack of memory of most that happened. Many men staring at me and talk I did not understand. But towards the last, as though a beam of sunlight had dashed through a cloud rift, there was a face I knew. A glimpse, the merest glimmer, and yet it glows in my memory ever stronger and brighter.
Torin said, Who was it?
That captain who was with us so long a time ago, when first you saved me from slavery.
It had obviously been Magnifico's intention to create a sensation, and the delighted smile that curled broadly in the shadow of his proboscis attested to his realization of the intention's success.
Captain Han Pritcher, demanded Meese sternly.
You're sure of that? Certain sure now?
Sir, I swear, and he laid a bone-thin hand upon his narrow chest.
I would uphold the truth of it before the mule and swear it in his teeth, though all his power were behind him to deny it.
Beta said in pure wonder, Then what's it all about?
The clown faced her eagerly.
My lady, I have a theory.
It came upon me, ready-made, as though the galactic spirit had gently laid it in my mind.
He actually raised his voice above Torin's interrupting objection.
My lady,
he addressed himself exclusively to Beta, if this captain had, like us, escaped with a ship, if he, like us, were on a trip for a purpose of his own devising, if he blundered upon us, he would suspect us of following and waylaying him, as we suspect him of the like. What wonder he played this comedy to enter our ship?
Why would he want us in his ship, then? Demanded Torin.
That doesn't fit.
Why, yes, it does, clamored the clown with a flowing inspiration.
He sent an underling who knew us not, but who described us into his microphone. The listening captain would be struck at my own poor likeness. For of a truth there are not many in this great galaxy who bear a resemblance to my scantiness. I was the proof of the identity of the rest of you.
And so he leaves us.
What do we know of his mission and the secrecy thereof? He has spied us out for not an enemy, and having it done so, must he needs think it wise to risk his plan by widening the knowledge thereof?
Beta said slowly, Don't be stubborn, Tori. It does explain things.
It could be, agreed Meese.
Torin seemed helpless in the face of united resistance. Something in the clown's fluent explanations bothered him. Something was wrong. Yet he was bewildered, and in spite of himself, his anger ebbed.
For a while, he whispered, I thought we might have had one of the mule's ships. And his eyes were dark with the pain of Haven's loss. The others understood.
Neo Trantor. The small planet of Delicas, renamed after the Great Sack, was for nearly a century the seat of the last dynasty of the First Empire. It was a shadow world and a shadow empire, and its existence is only of legalistic importance. Under the first of the Neo-Trantorian dynasty, Encyclopedia Galactica. Chapter 22. Death on Neo-Trantor.
Neo-Trantor was the name. New Trantor. and when you have said the name, you have exhausted at a stroke all the resemblances of the new Trantor to the great original. 2 parsecs away, the sun of old Trantor still shone, and the galaxy's imperial capital of the previous century still cut through space in the silent and eternal repetition of its orbit. Men even inhabited old Trantor. Not many. 100 million, perhaps, where 50 years before 40 billions had swarmed. The huge metal world was in jagged splinters. The towering thrusts of the multi-towers from the single world-girdling base were torn and empty, still bearing the original blast holes and fire gut, shards of the great sack of 40 years earlier. It was strange that a world which had been the center of a galaxy for 2,000 years, that had ruled limitless space and been home to legislators and rulers whose whims spanned the parsecs, could die in a month. It was strange that a world which had been untouched through the vast conquering sweeps and retreats of a millennia, and equally untouched by the civil wars and palace revolutions of other millennia, should lie dead at last. It was strange that the glory of the galaxy should be a rotting corpse. And pathetic. For centuries would yet pass before the mighty works of 50 generations of humans would decay past use. Only the declining powers of men themselves rendered them useless now. The millions left after the billions had died tore up the gleaming metal base of the planet and exposed soil that had not felt the touch of sun in 1,000 years. Surrounded by the mechanical perfections of human efforts, encircled by the industrial marvels of mankind, freed from the tyranny of environment, they returned to the land. In the huge traffic clearings, wheat and corn grew. In the shadow of the towers, sheep grazed. But Neo Trantor existed, an obscure village of a planet drowned in the shadow of mighty Trantor, until a heart-throttled royal family, racing before the fire and flame of the great sack, sped to it as its last refuge, and held out there, barely, until the roaring wave of rebellion subsided. There it ruled in ghostly splendor over a cadaverous remnant of Imperium. 20 agricultural worlds were a galactic empire. Dagobert the Ninth, ruler of 20 worlds of refractory squires and sullen peasants, was Emperor of the Galaxy, Lord of the Universe. Dagobert the Ninth had been 25 on the bloody day he arrived with his father upon Neo Trantor. His eyes and mind were still alive with the glory and the power of the empire that was. But his son, who might one day be Dagobert the Tenth, was born on Neo Trantor. 20 worlds were all he knew. Yord Kamason's open-air car was the first vehicle of its type on all Neo Trantor, and after all, justly so. It did not end with the fact that Kamason was the largest landowner on Neo Trantor. It began there. For in earlier days he had been the companion and evil genius of a young crown prince, restive in the dominating grip of a middle-aged emperor. And now he was the companion and still the evil genius of a middle-aged crown prince who hated and dominated an old emperor. So Yord Kamason, in his air car, which in mother-of-pearl finish and gold and lumitron ornamentation needed no coat of arms as owner's identification, surveyed the lands that were his, and the miles of rolling wheat that were his, and the huge threshers and harvesters that were his, and the tenant farmers and machine tenders that were his, and considered his problems cautiously. Beside him, his bent and withered chauffeur guided the ship gently through the upper winds and smiled. Yord Kamason spoke to the wind, the air, and the sky. "You remember what I told you, Inchni?" Inchni's thin gray hair wisped lightly in the wind. His gap-toothed smile widened in its thin-lipped fashion, and the vertical wrinkles of his cheeks deepened as though he were keeping an eternal secret from himself. The whisper of his voice whistled between his teeth. I remember, sire, and I have thought.
And what have you thought, Inchne?
There was an impatience about the question.
Inchne remembered that he had been young and handsome, and a lord on old Trantor. Inchne remembered that he was a disfigured ancient on Neo-Trantor, who lived by grace of Squire Yord Comason, and paid for the grace by lending his subtlety on request. He sighed very softly. He whispered again, Visitors from the Foundation, sire, are a convenient thing to have. Especially, sire, when they come with but a single ship, and but a single fighting man. How welcome they might be.
Welcome, said Comason gloomily.
Perhaps so. But those men are magicians, and may be powerful.
Pah, muttered Inchne. The mistiness of distance hides the truth.
The Foundation is but a world. Its citizens are but men. If you blast them, they die.
Inchne held the ship on its course. A river was a winding sparkle below. He whispered, And is there not a man they speak of now who stirs the worlds of the periphery?
Comason was suddenly suspicious.
What do you know of this?
There was no smile on his chauffeur's face.
Nothing, sire. It is but an idle question.
The squire's hesitation was short. He said with brutal directness, Nothing you ask is idle, and your method of acquiring knowledge will have your scrawny neck in a vice yet.
But I have it.
This man is called the Mule, and a subject of his had been here some months ago on a matter of business. I await another, now, for its conclusion.
And these newcomers, they are not the ones you want, perhaps.
They lack the identification they should have.
It has been reported that the Foundation has been captured.
I did not tell you that.
It has been so reported, continued Inchne coolly, and if that is correct, then these may be refugees from the destruction, and may be held for the Mule's man out of honest friendship.
Yes?
Comason was uncertain. And, sire, since it is well known that the friend of a conqueror is but the last victim, it would be but a measure of honest self-defense. For there are such things as psychic probes, and here we have 4 Foundation brains. There is much about the Foundation it would be useful to know, much even about the Mule. And then the Mule's friendship would be a trifle the less overpowering.
Comason, in the quiet of the upper air, returned with a shiver to his first thought. But if the Foundation has not fallen, if the reports are lies, it is said that it has been foretold it cannot fall.
We are past the age of soothsayers, sire.
And yet, if it did not fall, Inchne,
think, if it did not fall. The Mule made me promises indeed.
He had gone too far and backtracked. That is, he made boasts. But boasts are wind and deeds are hard.
Inchne laughed noiselessly. Deeds are hard indeed until begun.
One could scarcely find a further fear than a galaxy end foundation.
There is still the prince, murmured Comason almost to himself. He deals with the Mule also then, sire.
Comason could not quite choke down the complacent shift of features. Not entirely. Not as I do. But he grows wilder, more uncontrollable. A demon is upon him. If I seize these people and he takes them away for his own use, for he does not lack a certain shrewdness, I am not yet ready to quarrel with him." He frowned, and his heavy cheeks bent downwards with dislike. "I saw those strangers for a few moments yesterday," said the gray chauffeur irrelevantly, "and it is a strange woman, that dark one. She walks with the freedom of a man, and she is of a startling paleness against the dark luster of hair." There was almost a warmth in the husky whisper of the withered voice, so that Commason turned toward him in sudden surprise. Inchney continued, "The prince, I think, would not find his shrewdness proof against a reasonable compromise. You could have the rest, if you left him the girl." A light broke upon Carmason. A thought. Indeed, a thought. Inchney, turn back. And Inchney, if all turns well, we will discuss further this matter of your freedom. It was with an almost superstitious sense of symbolism that Carmason found a personal capsule waiting for him in his private study when he returned. It had arrived by a wavelength known to few. Carmason smiled a fat smile. The mule's man was coming, and the foundation had indeed fallen. Beta's misty visions, when she had them, of an imperial palace, did not jibe with the reality, and inside her there was a vague sense of disappointment. The room was small, almost plain, almost ordinary. The palace did not even match the mayor's residence back at the foundation, and Dagobert the Ninth. Beta had definite ideas of what an emperor ought to look like. He ought not look like somebody's benevolent grandfather. He ought not be thin and white and faded, or serving cups of tea with his own hand in an expressed anxiety for the comfort of his visitors. But so it was. Dagobert the Ninth chuckled as he poured tea into her stiffly outheld cup. "This is a great pleasure for me, my dear. It is a moment away from ceremony and courtiers. I have not had the opportunity for welcoming visitors from my outer provinces for a time now. My son takes care of these details now that I'm older. You haven't met my son? A fine boy. Headstrong, perhaps. But then he's young. Do you care for a flavor capsule? No?"
Torin attempted an interruption. "Your Imperial Majesty..."
"Yes?"
"Your Imperial Majesty, it has not been our intention to intrude upon you."
"Nonsense, there is no intrusion. Tonight, there will be the official reception, but until then we are free. Let's see, where did you say you were from? It seems a long time since we had an official reception. You said you were from the province of Anacreon?"
"From the Foundation, Your Imperial Majesty."
"Yes, the Foundation. I remember now. I had it located. It is in the province of Anacreon. I have never been there. My doctor forbids extensive traveling. I don't recall any recent reports from my viceroy at Anacreon. How are conditions there?" he concluded anxiously.
"Sire," mumbled Torin, "I bring no complaints."
"That is gratifying. I will commend my viceroy."
Torin looked helplessly at Ebling Mies, whose brusque voice rose. "Sire, we have been told that it will require your permission for us to visit the Imperial University Library on Trantor."
"Trantor?" questioned the Emperor mildly. "Trantor?"
Then a look of puzzled pain crossed his thin face.
"Trantor," he whispered. "I remember now.
I am making plans now to return there with a flood of ships at my back. You shall come with me. Together we will destroy the rebel Gilmer. Together we shall restore the Empire.
His bent back had straightened. His voice had strengthened. For a moment his eyes were hard. Then he blinked and said softly,
"But Gilmer is dead. I seem to remember. Yes. Yes. Gilmer is dead. Trantor is dead. For a moment it seemed. Where was it you said you came from?"
Magnifico whispered to Beta,
"Is this really an emperor? For somehow I thought emperors were greater and wiser than ordinary men."
Beta motioned him quiet. She said,
"If your Imperial Majesty would but sign an order permitting us to go to Trantor, it would avail greatly the common cause." "To Trantor?"
The Emperor was blank and uncomprehending.
"Sire, the Viceroy of Anacreon, in whose name we speak, sends word that Gilmer is yet alive."
"Alive? Alive!" thundered Dagobert. "Where? It will be war."
"Your Imperial Majesty, it must not yet be known. His whereabouts are uncertain. The Viceroy sends us to acquaint you of the fact, and it is only on Trantor that we may find his hiding place. Once discovered..."
"Yes, yes. He must be found." The old emperor doddered to the wall and touched the little photo cell with a trembling finger. He muttered, after an ineffectual pause,
"My servants do not come.
I cannot wait for them." He was scribbling on a blank sheet and ended with a flourished D. He said, "Gilmer will yet learn the power of his emperor."
"Where was it you came from?"
"Anacreon.
What are the conditions there?
Is the name of the emperor powerful?"
Beta took the paper from his loose fingers. "Your Imperial Majesty is beloved by the people. Your love for them is widely known."
"I shall have to visit my good people of Anacreon. But my doctor says..." "I don't remember what he says, but..."
He looked up, his old gray eyes sharp.
"Were you saying something of Gilmer?"
"No, Your Imperial Majesty. He shall not advance further. Go back and tell your people that Trantor shall hold. My father leads the fleet now, and the rebel vermin Gilmer shall freeze in space with his regicidal rabble."
He staggered into a seat, and his eyes were blank once more.
"What was I saying?"
Torin rose and bowed low. "Your Imperial Majesty has been kind to us, but the time allotted us for an audience is over." For a moment, Dagobert the Ninth looked like an emperor indeed as he rose and stood stiff-backed while, one by one, his visitors retreated backward through the door to where 20 armed men intervened and locked a circle about them. A hand weapon flashed. To Beta, consciousness returned sluggishly, but without the where-am-I sensation. She remembered clearly the odd old man who called himself emperor and the other men who waited outside. The arthritic tingle in her finger joints meant a stun pistol. She kept her eyes closed and listened with painful attention to the voices. There were two of them. One was slow and cautious, with a slyness beneath the surface obsequity. The other was hoarse and thick, almost sodden, and blurted out in viscous spurts. Beta liked neither. The thick voice was predominant.
Beta caught the last words. He will live forever, that old madman. It wearies me. It annoys me. Come, Mason, I will have it. I grow older, too.
Your Highness, let us first see of what use these people are. It may be we shall have sources of strength other than your father still provides.
The thick voice was lost in a bubbling whisper. Beta caught only the phrase, the girl. But the other, fawning voice was a nasty, low, running chuckle followed by a comradely, near-patronizing, Dagobert, you do not age. They lie who say you are not a youth of 20. They laughed together, and Beta's blood was an icy trickle. Dagobert, your Highness. The old emperor had spoken of a headstrong son, and the implication of the whispers now beat dully upon her. But such things didn't happen to people in real life. Torin's voice broke upon her in a slow, hard current of cursing. She opened her eyes, and Torin's, which were upon her, showed open relief. He said fiercely, "This banditry will be answered by the Emperor. Release us!" It dawned upon Beta that her wrists and ankles were fastened to wall and floor by a tight attraction field. Thick voice approached Torin. He was paunchy. His lower eyelids puffed darkly, and his hair was thinning out. There was a gay feather in his peaked hat, and the edging of his doublet was embroidered with silvery metal foam. He sneered with a heavy amusement. "The Emperor? The poor, mad Emperor? I have his pass. No subject may hinder our freedom." "But I am no subject, space garbage. I am the regent and crown prince, and am to be addressed as such. As for my poor, silly father, it amuses him to see visitors occasionally, and we humor him. It tickles his mock imperial fancy. But, of course, it has no other meaning." And then he was before Beta, and she looked up at him contemptuously. He leaned close, and his breath was overpoweringly minted. He said, "Her eyes suit well, Calmason. She is even prettier with them open. I think she'll do. It will be an exotic dish for a jaded taste, eh?" There was a futile surge upwards on Torin's part, which the Crown Prince ignored, and Beta felt the iciness travel outward to the skin. Ebling Mies was still out, head lolling weakly upon his chest, but with a sensation of surprise, Beta noted that Magnifico's eyes were open, sharply open, as though awake for many minutes. Those large brown eyes swiveled toward Beta and stared at her out of a doughy face. He whimpered and nodded with his head towards the Crown Prince. "That one has my visi sonar." The Crown Prince turned sharply toward the new voice. "This is yours, monster?" He swung the instrument from his shoulder where it had hung, suspended by its green strap, unnoticed by Beta. He fingered it clumsily, tried to sound a chord, and got nothing for his pains. "Can you play it, monster?" Magnifico nodded once. Torin said suddenly, "You've rifled a ship of the Foundation. If the Emperor will not avenge, the Foundation will." It was the other, Calmason, who answered slowly, "What Foundation? Or is the mule no longer the mule?" There was no answer to that. The prince's grin showed large, uneven teeth. The clown's binding field was broken, and he was nudged ungently to his feet. The visi sonar was thrust into his hand. "Play for us, monster," said the prince.
play us a serenade of love and beauty for our foreign lady here. Tell her that my father's country prison is no palace, but that I can take her to one where she can swim in rose water and know what a prince's love is. Sing of a prince's love, monster. He placed one thick thigh upon a marble table and swung a leg idly, while his fatuous smiling stare swept Beta into a silent rage. Torin's sinews strained against the field in painful, perspiring effort. Ebling Meese stirred and moaned. Magnifico gasped, "My fingers are of useless stiffness." "Play, monster," roared the prince. The lights dimmed at a gesture to Carmason, and in the dimness he crossed his arms and waited. Magnifico drew his fingers in rapid, rhythmic jumps from end to end of the multi-keyed instrument, and a sharp, gliding rainbow of light jumped across the room. A low, soft tone sounded, throbbing, tearful. It lifted in sad laughter, and underneath it there sounded a dull tolling. The darkness seemed to intensify and grow thick. Music reached Beta through the muffled folds of invisible blankets. Gleaming light reached her from the depths as though a single candle glowed at the bottom of a pit. Automatically, her eyes strained. The light brightened, but remained blurred. It moved fuzzily in confused color, and the music was suddenly brassy, evil, flourishing in high crescendo. The light flickered quickly in swift motion to the wicked rhythm. Something writhed within the light. Something with poisonous metallic scales writhed and yawned, and the music writhed and yawned with it. Beta struggled with a strange emotion and then caught herself in a mental gasp. Almost it reminded her of the time in the time vault, of those last days on Haven. It was that horrible, cloying, clinging spiderweb of horror and despair. She shrunk beneath it, oppressed. The music dinned upon her, laughing horribly, and the writhing terror at the wrong end of the telescope in the small circle of light was lost as she turned feverishly away. Her forehead was wet and cold. The music died. It must have lasted 15 minutes, and a vast pleasure at its absence flooded Beta. Light glared, and Magnifico's face was close to hers, sweaty, wild-eyed, lugubrious. "My lady," he gasped, "how fare you?" "Well enough," she whispered. "But why did you play like that?" She became aware of the others in the room. Torin and Mies were limp and helpless against the wall, but her eyes skimmed over them. There was the prince, lying strangely still at the foot of the table. There was Carmason, moaning wildly through an open, drooling mouth. Carmason flinched and yelled mindlessly as Magnifico took a step toward him. Magnifico turned, and with a leap, turned the others loose. Torin lunged upwards and with eager, taut fists seized the landowner by the neck. "You come with us. We'll want you to make sure we get to our ship." 2 hours later, in the ship's kitchen, Beta served a walloping homemade pie, and Magnifico celebrated the return to space by attacking it with a magnificent disregard of table manners. "Good, Magnifico. Mmm-hmm. Magnifico?"
"Yes, my lady."
"What was it you played back there?" The clown writhed.
I'd rather not say. I learned it once, and the visisonar is of an effect upon the nervous system most profound.
Surely it was an evil thing, and not for your sweet innocence, my lady." "Oh, now come, Magnifico. I'm not as innocent as that. Don't flatter so. Did I see anything like what they saw?
I hope not. I played it for them only. If you saw, it was but the rim of it.